Welcome to the Geriatric Journal Club, featuring practical discussions on the front line of PALTC issues that you wrestle with every day. This week's Geriatric Journal Club is a joint presentation of the Florida Journal Club and the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care. References for this podcast and links to previous recordings can be found at paltc.org/journalclub. Support for this podcast is brought to you by U.S. Post-Acute Care.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is the Florida Medical Directors Association, the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care Journal Club. Today's date is March 25th, 2020, and I am your presenter, Dr. Diane Sanders-Cepeda. I want to talk to you today and talk through a COVID-19 update. This is something that I want to bring to you, but I don't want to be the only voice talking, so we will have time for open discussion at the end of the presentation. Please note that this presentation is being recorded. Our agenda today is to go over a status report of where we're at with COVID-19 and updates for the post-acute and long-term care community. We also want to talk to telehealth as the updates around that, as well as the clinical trials that we're seeing, and as I said earlier, have an open discussion to talk through some questions. So just the state of the state, what we're seeing is that every state is being touched with COVID-19. We're also finding that in many of our territories, we're also experiencing cases. And we are at the point where we are now seeing our hospitals being overran with COVID-19 cases. This is a snapshot of Florida. I sit in Broward County, and we just wanted to show you what is happening in Florida. And this was updated at 11 a.m. on today's date, March 25th. And we're already at near 1,500 cases in Florida. We are monitoring another 1,200. We've done over 16,000 tests, and as of 11 a.m., 1,467 were positive. There was an emergency order that came out on March 11th, which was from the governor, Governor DeSantis, governor of Florida. And we saw some issues with the way our providers were being able to go into the facilities secondary to this order. We did push back. This order was around visitation. And what it stated was that all non-essential visitors were to be turned away from the facility. Anyone who had any exposure traveling internally or to certain domestic airports were to not be allowed in. And unfortunately, we did see where some providers throughout the state of Florida had issues getting into the nursing homes to see their patients. We were able to circle back and push back and make sure that they understand that all medical providers, healthcare providers, whether they're physicians, physician assistants, or nurse practitioners, are essential to the healthcare of our residents in post-acute and long-term care. Also wanted to go through a couple of other updates. On March 17, there was an 1135 Medicaid waiver. Florida was the first state to request that waiver. What it allows is for us to be able to provide care in alternative settings, such as hotels, cruise ships, if we needed to use some of those facilities, just in case a licensed facility needed to be evacuated. It waives prior authorization requirements. It also suspends some nursing center screening requirements. It does some other things for administrative purposes, but the key is that it allows us to get ready just in case we see that we need to close down a facility. And as of today, we have 126 nursing homes in 27 states that we know of that have a COVID-19 positive case. So we are anticipating those numbers to grow and to expand. I also wanted to show you some things that we've take it that are now impacting our state. We have residential and long-term care facilities need to implement universal use of facial masks. that came through last week on, I believe, the 18th of March. And it was effective immediately for all of the staff, as well as any visitors who were coming into the facility. They must wear a facial mask at all times. I do know that there is a shortage of personal protective equipment. There are a lot of great resources on the Florida Healthcare Agency's website, FHCA. And what I found that to be very helpful was to note that if a facility is experiencing a shortage, they could call their county emergency management office and report that. There is a form that is on FHCA's website that you can complete for your facility. If we have any directors of nursing or administrators on, you can complete it for your facility. You can send it forward and report that you're having a shortage. It's not an immediate fix. It all depends on the supplies they have in the county's emergency management office, but at least we get on the list. I also wanted to review a very recent update made on March 23rd. CMS did a really in-depth survey of what happened at Kirkland Nursing Home, which was at the beginning of this, the nursing facility in Washington. And they created a new targeted plan for healthcare facility inspections in light of this pandemic. So it's a three-pronged survey approach. And first it says, you know, those standard state surveys that we're all so used to and love, those are going to be suppressed for now. So we're not gonna see those coming at this moment in time. But any complaint survey and any question around if there is an infection control issue, those surveys will still go about. And then there's also the self-assessment infection control tool that's going to be provided to all the facilities from the CDC. And the goal of that is to really mitigate risk and reduce any further transmission and exposure. So one thing that I've received a lot of questions, I think we've all received a lot of questions around, was telehealth. And that benefit was expanded with the March 6th Act that was signed, the Coronavirus Preparedness and Response Supplemental Appropriations Act. And what we found is that with those acts, you know, we are now seeing that we can have a more access and more ability to use telehealth now in our skilled nursing setting. So I wanted to go through some of the telehealth codes because there's quite a few things. Before I say that, I want to make sure that we understand what we need, what this means. So it doesn't mean that you have to have an established relationship with a patient. You do not need to have any additional equipment. All you need is a telephone that has audio and video capabilities. This right here is the first two initial G codes. These are for brief check-ins where you may be able to get images from a patient, or you may be able to communicate in a technology-based service such as a text message. You could do a virtual check-in with your patients and build these two codes. The next three G codes are for patients to communicate with their doctors without going into the doctors. So this is like the virtual check-in, but if you have a question, if you need an issue, you could build one of these codes for that exchange with that member, that patient. The online digital evaluation and management service codes are for patient-initiated services with a physician or other qualified healthcare professional. So these would be the codes that will take place of your A&M codes that you're currently billing out in the nursing facilities or your office. So there are three codes here, depending on the time that you spent. When you're doing a telehealth code, the place of service that you need to have is 02. You do not need to include any other modifiers. So the modifier 95 is gone. So you don't have to worry about that if you see that as some old literature. With this act, the only thing you need to do is have the place of service in these codes. If you are in Alaska and Hawaii and you're working with a program that was designated by the federal government, then you still need to include GQ code. If you are in a rural health clinic or a federally qualified health center, you still need to include the GT code. And there is another code for anyone managing an acute stroke, which is more likely for inpatient management. That's a GO code. But for us, for those who are practicing in the long-term care, post-acute settings, in the office setting, or doing who are home care physicians, assisted living physicians who are now implementing telehealth, you do not need a modifier. You just need to designate that the place of service was 02. Some other good news that's come down, we knew that we were going to see an ICD-10 code come through for COVID-19 in October. I think there was a lot of pressure on the World Health Organization to move this forward faster, not only from the different governments, the different insurers, but just the medical community. And I think, we have made a lot of progress in that regard. So, given that we declared a national emergency, the World Health Organization and the Centers for Disease Control decided that we needed to release the ICD-10 code earlier. The ICD-10 code for COVID-19 is U07.1, and that will now be effective on April 1st, 2020. There is also a HCPCS code for the COVID testing that should be effective by April 1st, 2020 as well. I do not have that code number. It's a lot of codes, but we could definitely get it for you if we need to. I wanna go through some of the COVID-19 clinical trials because we have had a lot of questions and there's been a lot of feedback provided around the different medications. We know that there was a press conference that was had recently where it was mentioned that Plaquenil was the leading treatment option for COVID-19. We also know that there's been some more information out about azithromycin, which is Zithromax, and you could think about your Z-Packs, and some other treatments that people have been sharing either via Twitter, things that we're seeing popping up in the media. And I want to just bring some clarity to that. Currently, right now, we do not have an FDA-approved treatment for COVID-19. So those conversations are really being sparked by case studies that we're seeing, different small clinical trials that may be going on where they're seeing some benefits, as well as the in vitro trials that have gone on, where they're looking at COVID-19 under a petri dish and doing testing to see which drugs it responds to. So I don't want us to get that confused with what we're seeing and what we're talking about. So in the New England Journal of Medicine, and I will just say that if you're looking for a journal to turn to right now, the New England Journal of Medicine has a lot of original content, a lot of free content that you could pull down. And I may butcher these two drug names, but they have a trial of lopinavir and ritonavir in adults hospitalized with severe COVID-19 that they were able to publish. Unfortunately, what we saw with this study is that it did not show any true benefit to those patients who were suffering from severe COVID-19. One of the limitations is that they were only looking at that small sample size, but there is a lot of research to be done still around what happens if you have mild symptoms. There is also a great article that appeared on JAMA on Tuesday about treating COVID-19 off-label drug use, compassionate use, and randomized clinical trials during pandemics. And this was really speaking to the fact that just because we think it could possibly work doesn't mean we need to go ahead and start it without actually doing the proper amount of research and science that is needed. it spoke to the fact that there are several clinical trials that are going, but we need to be careful because many of these drugs, as we know, have severe either adverse reactions or side effects that a patient could experience, the QT prolongations with some of these drugs. You know, we don't want to just start experimenting and hoarding medications. And that brings to another point of drug hoarding and what we're seeing across the country is certain areas where physicians are now prescribing themselves huge amounts of Plaquenil. We have to be very careful, and we don't want to do that. We don't want to overreact. We want to know and be prepared and let science lead during these times. There are some other emerging treatment challenges that we have found. One is around shortages with albuterol. Albuterol is being used for the mild symptoms. We'll get albuterol inhalers being dispensed to help with some of those respiratory symptoms. And nebulized treatments are becoming a part of that regimen that we see in inpatient settings. What we are now getting informed about is that these medications we're experiencing shortages of these medications in certain areas of the country. There was also some literature around ACE and ARBs, and the question was about, should we use this given that there is some suspected binding of the proteins with the ARBs and the ACEs? And currently, all of the cardiology societies, the three leading cardiology societies in America, are saying continue your ACEs, continue your ARBs, do not subvert treatment. And like I said, there's still science that needs to happen around that. And right now the recommendation is to continue on those medications. The other question we saw, as we're seeing more case studies around how non-steroidals have not been helpful in treating COVID-19 symptoms. In some of those case studies, there have been reports that it actually worsened the symptoms. It currently, what I've seen is that the medical community at large is avoiding using non-steroidals for these patients. The other thing that I read about recently was around steroid treatments and steroids. You know, we think about it a lot as part of our first line management for a COPD exacerbation. We're finding more support that may not be a first line type of treatment for COVID-19. And I recently saw an Itisavis out of Washington State say, you know, we should probably stop using the inhaled corticosteroids on COPD patients who have COVID-19 as it may worsen their symptoms. There's no clear communication. I haven't seen anything come out of the pulmonology societies about that yet, but it's just something to be aware of.
Delivering true excellence in post-acute medicine requires more investment, resources, and infrastructure than ever before. U.S. Post-Acute Care, a physician-led practice group, has built a business model dedicated to providing high-quality post-acute patient care on a national scale. We make it easy and beneficial for regional practices to leverage our resources to drive the growth and quality of their practices. Visit our website at uspostacutecare.com to see for yourself. Together, we'll be stronger.
Now, that leads us to some outstanding questions that we are receiving. And one is, when can healthcare workers return to work? There is some information on the FHCA that speaks about returning to work in 3 days. If you haven't been tested, if you're not tested and you haven't had symptoms, but you were suspected, maybe you could return to work in 3 days, and then there's some counter information about returning in 7 days. I do think you probably should play it safe for the healthcare workers and not return until 7 days after you've had symptoms in the non-tested environment. if you've been tested and been found to be positive, then you cannot return to work until you have two consecutive negative tests. They could be 24 hours apart, but you have to have two of them at this time. What are we doing about the personalized protective equipment shortages? As I said, there are emergency management offices in every county in Florida. I'm not aware of all the particulars in every other state, but I do know as a nation, we are trying to address the shortages. There is some good information on the CDC's website about what to do, and we're telling everyone to follow the CDC guidance, even if you have to use other types of equipment for protective equipment, to follow the CDC latest recommendations. If you know that your facility is about to experience a shortage, my recommendation is, even if you're not in the state of Florida, to contact the emergency management office in your county and or in your state so that you can report that and let it be known that we are in need of that protective equipment. What happens is if a resident tests positive for COVID-19? So there's some really great handouts on AMDA's website. They have a lot of great recommendations around this. You know, there's been some debate on whether if a person was to test positive, if they should be sent automatically to the hospital. I do not necessarily agree with that recommendation. I think there is a call to treat a place. You know, if we can make sure that that person is isolated, even if it's a suspected case, if we could isolate those patients in the facilities, I think that would be a better approach than trying to send them to a place where we know that they have a higher risk of getting infected, and there may be a difficulty in treating and managing them. And this really depends, and you know, it is a clinical decision that is going to depend on the conversations you have with that facility, the family. You know, this is a call for advanced care planning and to have some proactive discussions and contingency plans in place so that you could talk through with your facilities and the families and the residents about what we need to do just in case we get sick. When do we need to be transferred to a higher level of acuity? What can they do that we are not able to provide? So I think it's really the time and place to have those discussions are now before we start seeing any more cases in our nursing facilities. It behooves us to really get with our administrators and our directors of nursing, whether you're the medical director of the facility or you're just attending to someone's care there, you are part of that medical staff. And it's really important for you to know what we need to do to treat these people in their homes. The same goes for any patients you may see at home. You need to really have a conversation with the family members around a treated place contingency plan. What do we need to have on hand just in case we need to keep them here and treat them in their homes? And I will say that applies to facilities. You could talk to their nursing directors and their, if there's a medical director there, and if not, as most facilities do not have, you could talk to the management and just make a plan. Now, if their symptoms are worsening, if they're declining rapidly and they are severely short of breath and you cannot treat them in place, then that is when they need to go to a higher level of acuity. But I really do believe in being proactive and having those conversations and looking at when you're having an advanced care planning conversation, really having the discussion, do you want to be hospitalized? Do you want to be intubated? Do you want to be resuscitated? It is time for us to, you know, I know we are doing those things, but it is really time for us to kick that in gear. And then there's been a lot of discussion on what we need to do to receive a COVID-19 patient from the local hospital, the guidance around that. We know we've seen where certain facilities are pushing back against accepting a COVID-19 positive patient. And in the state of Florida, we now have updated and really answered the question with hospital transfers through a new hospital transfer form so that the facilities could get much more information. If you are receiving someone who's COVID-19 positive, I would say the same way, the same thoughts around how to treat a person in place would apply here, where you will follow the guidance around isolation and whatever other recommendations the CDC has in place for someone who's stable to be discharged from a hospital with a COVID-19 positive diagnosis, but yet have not tested negative on two consecutive tests. So we need to lean back into those CDC recommendations for that question. We are really interested in knowing about anything that you guys are doing out of the community, any best care practices that we could discuss. And we are definitely here to take any questions. With that, we will have an open discussion, which will not be recorded. And I do thank you all for your participation. Thank you.
Hey, thank you, Dr. Sanders-Pitt. That was great.
Support for this podcast is brought to you by U.S. Post-Acute Care.